الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله القائل في محكم كتابه العزيز، سبحان الذي أسرى بعبده ليلا من المسجد الحرام إلى المسجد الأقصى الذي باركنا حوله لنريه من آياتنا إنه هو السميع البصير. وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله القادر والباسط الرافع والخافض المعز والمذل، بيده الخير وهو على كل شيء قدير. وأشهد أن سيدنا ومولانا وإمامنا وقائدنا محمدا صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم عبده ورسوله، ما ودعك ربك وما قلى، وللآخرة خير لك من الأولى، ولسوف يعطيك ربك فترضى. أما بعد، brothers and sisters, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. I begin by thanking every one of you for being here this afternoon. And I also would like to thank those who have thought out, organized, and implemented this program that brings us all together. I think the idea is very encouraging to have Muslims step over the artificial barriers that have been imposed on us, whether they have a religious character or whether they have a national character or whether they have a racial character, whatever other character they may have. It's about time Muslims began to transcend these artificial walls of separation that have had us in the previous centuries and generations become the victims of imposed powers, military powers and mental powers and everything in between. We've suffered from that for so long. It's about time some people began to think about coming together and agreeing on what we all share in common. I would like to say, before I begin my thoughts on this occasion, that I try as much as possible to break out of the usual wording that we have on such occasions. It's like Muslims have a particular English vocabulary that gets us stuck in a rut out of which we cannot think properly. For that reason, I choose to retool my thoughts with other words to help you and to help us all together move ahead, and rather than being stagnant in the general area of ideas that we have. If you heard it once, you've heard it for all the times. So I just want you and all of us to try as much as possible to get out of that. I will also try to break with tradition. I know these are harsh words. Tradition sometimes has a positive shadow to it, or shade to it. What I mean by this is that the way al-Isra and al-Mi'raj is spoken or is explained has a tradition to it. And I will, with your patience, I will try to break loose from approaching this subject matter in that traditional approach. I will begin by saying that al-Isra and al-Mi'raj took place before the Hijrah by about 1 to 2 years. Now, as is the case with any researcher or anyone who's investigating the subject matter, you're always going to find Muslim historians and Muslim scholars having a difference of opinion. So it becomes very difficult to pinpoint a consensual exact date for when the Isra took place. The Isra and the Mi'raj took place, zeroing in on a day and a month and a year. So that way it becomes consciously comfortable to say that it happened between the 12th and the 13th year of the Hijrah, or between within those 2 years preceding the Prophet's move from Mecca to Al-Medina. What goes unnoticed in this initial movement towards what was called at the time Yathrib, because the Prophet obviously was not present in Medina, he was still in Mecca. So before he went to Yathrib, he was involved in a struggle. Many of us, we invoke the Prophet's name many times in our prayers, the ayat that are in the Quran referring to Allah's Prophet, the invocation of as-salat and as-salam upon him, the lectures, the presentations, how many times we hear about him. In the middle of all of this, unfortunately, we fail to remember a very important feature of the Prophet. This is a collective failure that we suffer from, all of us out here who we are. I'm sorry to say this, by the way. One of the features that doesn't come to our mind when we mention his name, alayhi salatu wassalam, is that he was a person who could be characterized after the age of 40, obviously, when he received the wahi. He was a person who spent his life in a struggle. As important as this is to remember, we fail to remember. When someone says Muhammad, or someone says the Prophet of Allah, or Rasulullah, or Nabiullah, etc., it doesn't occur to us. The first thing that should occur to us is that we are remembering a person who was involved in a lifelong struggle. That doesn't occur. And this is the first thing that we should remember when his name is mentioned. Because there is a build-up to al-Isra and al-Mi'raj. Isra and al-Mi'raj was not some incident that took place haphazardly. It was not one of these developments in the life of the Prophet that did not fit into a sequence of events. It was a calculated and a measured event in the lifetime struggle of Allah's Prophet. Now let us borrow the secular mind for a moment. That's if we are in our Islamic mind. Some of us don't even have to borrow it because planted with it since we are born. But if that secular mind was to take a look at the lifetime of Allah's Prophet, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his, we will find that this secular mind would look at him as a failure. And as is the case, it would present its evidence that this prophet is a failure. He began his mission by communicating this message from Allah to his first inner circle, his wife, his cousin, his best friend, and his stepson. Okay, so what happened? What type of results were there? Nothing much. What did his wife, his cousin, his stepson, and his best friend, what did they do to enhance the message of Islam in Mecca? So what do you say? Look at it. A failure. He remained for about 3 or 4 years spreading the word of Islam in a low-key manner from those who were nearer to him to those who were a little more at a distance to those who were at a distance yet a little more. And still, there's no dramatic change in the social life of Mecca. But a secular mind will tell you, hey, listen, look, this is a failure. You have a person who's been spending 3 or 4 years trying his best to communicate this message of Islam that he has. He says he's receiving something from heaven. And what do you have? Few dozen people here at the most in Mecca who have become Muslims after all of these years. In our dictionary, that's called a failure. Then we have, well, I hope some of us have some Islamic history in our mind. We have the details of that Meccan era. There was persecution, there was torture, there was ridicule, there was a psychological war against the Prophet and those who were with him. They tried to isolate him, they embargoed him, so to speak, into 3 years when he was in what is called Shi'a di Abi Talib. 3 years with those who were with him. What do we have here? Let's take a look. Let's be a little slow here. And go slow motion, looking at the character of this prophet and those who committed their lives to Allah and to him during these 3 years. What were they doing? The Meccan society had reduced them to sub-survival levels. No one could bring them any food. No one could bring them any water. They were boycotted in every social sense of the word. They were forced to chew on leather, to try to extract whatever nutrient there may be from lemon. What would the secular mind call that? Failure. Where is Muhammad going with this message of Islam? In the meantime, obviously this is the social and the material unfolding of facts. These are facts of our history. No one can deny them. There may be a give and take in trying to understand them, but the facts are there, solid, consensual, and have lived for 1,400 plus years. But on the flip side of this, we had a psychology that was not defeated. In the middle of all of this, when the social order was going into all that it had to try to break this prophet, using everything at its disposal, the prophet was sending some Muslims to Africa. The prophet was contacting the people who were coming to the Kaaba, whether they were the people of Hijaz or whether they were the people from Arabia. All of these people who were coming in droves throughout the year to Mecca, driven by their religious feelings, the prophet was there to speak to them. Remember the conditions we are speaking about, the physical and material conditions that we are speaking about, and his psychology was not defeated. Regardless of this, he still wanted contact with people, initiating either distant contact by sending Muslims to faraway lands, or by he himself going and speaking to the people who were coming to the Kaaba when the Kaaba was accessible. And in the middle of this, things happen that are not humanly calculated. The establishment of Mecca wanted, had a strategy, they were going to defeat this person, one of them. And as they were pursuing that strategy, uncalculated things happened. Some very important characters in this structure of Mecca joined the prophet. The underclass that joined the prophet is a given. This has been the case with the history of prophethood. You have the underclasses that would be the first supporters of the prophet. But to have someone influential from society join a prophet, that begins to ring bells of alarm in the establishment. Hamza ibn Abd al-Muttalib, the Prophet's uncle, a well-known figure in the Meccan society, now became a Muslim in these circumstances. That began to ring the alarm bells concerning the decision makers in Mecca at the time. They didn't like that. Umar ibn al-Khattab, another well-known figure in Mecca, joins the Prophet. And this also rings more alarm bells in the heads and in the planning fibers of the decision makers of the Meccan establishment. They didn't like that either. And then all of this was leading to the event that we're speaking about. We're supposed to be speaking here about al-Isra and al-Mi'raj. But as I said, al-Isra and al-Mi'raj did not occur in a vacuum. It occurred with these dynamics at work. The Prophet would know what is happening to Bilal, one of his followers. Torture. Torture to the extent that they wanted him to, his tormentors wanted to bring him to the point of renouncing his Islam in lieu of losing his life. Meaning, they brought him to the moments of life where you have a choice. Either you renounce your Islam or you lose your life. And he would not renounce his Islam. The Prophet would pass by the family of Ammar ibn Yasir, physically see them being tortured. And that was torture to him. And he would say, صَبْرًا آلَ يَاسَرَ فَإِنَّ مَوْعِدَكُمُ الْجَنَّةِ. Patience, family of Yasser. Your meeting point is going to be Al-Jannah. Then, what happens to him with all this physical and social pressure that was on him, what happens preceding, just before the Isra and the Mi'raj, the two persons that were a psychological refuge for him, his wife and his uncle, passed on. Those who offered him family and social comfort died that year. The secular mind would say, listen, we're not observing someone here who has anything to speak about in as far as success is concerned. Look at this, this is a failure. The Prophet himself, just before the Isra and the Mi'raj, left Mecca. He went to a Ta'if, seeking some type of support system or base of support in a Ta'if. And what they did was, because you have to understand here, a Ta'if and Mecca were very close societies. The closest two societies in the Hijaz. So what they did was they began throwing stones at him when he was leaving a Ta'if. Now if we just take a look at just two incidents. The incident in which the Prophet and those who committed themselves to Allah and to Him, when they were subsurviving for 3 years, did it ever occur to any of us that the Prophet was a very hungry man for 3 years? This is the Prophet that we say, Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, Sallallahu Alaihi Wa Alihi Wasallam. He was very hungry for 3 years. I think that doesn't occur to many of us when we evoke or invoke his name. When he was expelled from the Ta'if, when they threw stones at him, this is a prophet who had no protection at all. Nothing. It was within these types of psychological dynamics that Al-Isra and Al-Mi'raj occurred. Remember, the Prophet was struggling to have some type of demographic success in Mecca. Some type. It never happened. And then, all of a sudden, as if to turn a page in his history, this Isra and Mi'raj occurred. He was taken on a night journey from Mecca to Al-Quds, then from Al-Quds to the seven heavens above. It was like a tour de force. Here he was, locally involved in Mecca. A place in and of itself that is in the margins of the real world of the real world of the time. What was Mecca in the real world? It was just a habitat in a desolate desert. And from that isolated pocket, pocket of existence, from that area of the world that was cut away from civilization. And the Prophet was involved just in the local struggle there in Mecca, as local as you can get. Then Allah took him on this tour of the universe in its expanse of time and place. And some of the details we listened to concerning the particulars of meeting with the Anbiya, with the prophets and messengers of Allah. Here he was trying to convince the rulers and the people of Mecca concerning Islam, and they were turning him down. And Allah took him out of that, those 11 or 12 years of frustration and setbacks and intimidation and all types of campaigns against him. He took him out of that and he placed him in the presence of the leaders of the world. Ibrahim and Musa and Isa and the rest of these, and Noah and the rest of these prophets, these were the leaders of humanity, the leaders of history, the leaders of all the peoples of the world. He took them from that languishing status in Mecca, and now he was in the presence in a new world. Subhana, thus we read, Subhana alladhi asra bi'abdihi layla min al-masjid al-haram ila al-masjid al-aqsa alladhi barakna hawla linuriyahu min ayatina innahu huwa as-sami'u al-basir. The word abd that was used in the ayah, and the respected speaker spoke about in his presentation, the word abd, to break away, as I said, from the conventional choice of words, the word abd means a conforming subject. Allah Jalla wa Ala chose this word so that this development of al-Isra and al-Mi'raj can relate to us. But if said, Subhana alladhi asra bi nabiyyi min al-masjid al-haram ila al-masjid al-aqsa. He could have said, Subhana alladhi asra bi rasulihi min al-masjid al-haram ila al-masjid al-aqsa. He could have said, Subhana alladhi asra bi mustafahu min al-masjid al-haram ila al-masjid al-aqsa. But the word, the choice of word bi'abdihi, is deliberate, because it involves a abd, a conforming subject to Allah. And you and I, if we define ourselves as obedient to Allah, we gain that description. We become ibad Allah. Therefore, the incident, as it is worded here, relates to us. If Allah subhanahu could come to the rescue of his prophet, who he did not call his prophet on this occasion, he called his conforming subject, then he certainly can come to the rescue of others of his conforming subjects. He's not going to exclude us. He's not going to say this is a particular event that is specific to a prophet. This is an event that belongs to conforming subjects of Allah, ourselves included, if we meet the criteria. Subhana alladhi asra bi'abdihi layla min al-masjid al-haram ila al-masjid al-aqsa. There's a couple of thoughts that come to mind that understanding the words of Allah and understanding the works of His Prophet. The first thing that comes to mind is the choice, the direction of this movement. Remember, Allah has taken His Prophet on a night, His confirming subject, on a night journey from Mecca and of all other places in the world, it was to the Quds. Nowhere else. Now, this would have some meaning for people who are thinking. They're thinking of the details of the struggle then, and they're thinking of the details of the struggle now. What is established and is an alphabetical fact in the Muslim mind is that the Prophet of Allah at that time in Mecca was in a struggle with his social self. Now some people just, they can't understand what I'm saying. I've had a couple of brothers that have said this before, what do you mean by his social self? Well, there was an Arabian society that had an Arabian culture, that had Arabian traditions, that had Arabian history, and the Prophet was struggling against this, and that struggle was represented in the clash with the Meccan establishment, the Meccan order, the Meccan authority. That clash continued for a dozen years or so. That was a struggle with his social self. If we bring those facts to our world, and we look around and we ask, where are the Muslims who are in a struggle with their social self? We also belong to a social self. You have your national character, or you have your ethnic character, or you have your racial character, or you have some other type of cultural character. That is your social self. What the Prophet was doing was, he was in a struggle, a lifetime struggle with that social self that was wrong. Racism is wrong. Ethnic discrimination is wrong. Cultural bias is wrong. Gender prejudice is wrong. This was the struggle that he was in. And what happened? His social self was winning in Mecca in these first dozen years in his life. His social self was winning and his personal self was failing. If we take a look at it, as I said, with a secular mind, and this Isra and Mi'raj, the tour de force in the heavens, in the universe, where there's the convergence of time and place, عند سدرة المنتهى, was to have, true, there may have been a political failure or an economic failure in those times of duress in Mecca, but there was no psychological failure. And because there was no psychological failure, and he and those who were with him proved that they were a success psychologically, Allah subhanahu wanted to deliver them from that phase of history to a new phase of history. So he comes back and he speaks to the people around him, absent one night. And he says, I met on a night journey from Mecca to Al-Quds, and then from there I was taken on a heavenly journey, where I met with the Anbiya of Allah. Of course, the people who are at this level of war with him, they continue to ridicule him. Look, now he claims, this is what they said, it takes us about 30 days when we go on our caravans to get to Al-Quds, the area that he's speaking about. And here he's telling us he did it in one night? You gotta be kidding. This propaganda warfare against the Prophet even affected some Muslims. Some of these people who said that they committed themselves to Allah's Prophet, after hearing this had happened, said, no, we don't want to be Muslims anymore. The unfortunate fact in our history books is that we don't have the names of these characters. It's nice to know who these were, who at times like this stepped out of their commitment to Allah and His Prophet, who later on would probably rejoin the Muslim crowd and become maybe unreliable characters in Islamic history. We don't have their names, unfortunately. But this is one of the dynamics that happens as a struggle goes on. The struggle is real. Human nature is human nature. We have human beings who are strong and will withstand the pressure that is put on them. And we have others that are more weak. They can't. They can't take it anymore. And this is one of those junctures in Islamic history when we are exposed to characters who couldn't take the pressure anymore. But this brings us back to a very important point. That is, do we have the Prophet here? History speaks for itself. The Prophet here was involved in a struggle of over a decade with the society and the culture that was opposed to him in Mecca, against his social self. We ask, if we understand these events in context, we ask ourselves today, are we involved in a struggle against our social selves? Today, at least at that time, the Prophet had access to the Kaaba and to the Haram. With all the pressure that was put on him, no one was telling him you could not come and speak your mind in the Kaaba, around the Haram. Today, we have a regime, we have an authority, or an establishment, officials, who rule over the Kaaba and the Haram. And if you don't believe me, try it. Try to go to Mecca or to Al-Madinah and speak to the people the language of the Prophet. And I tell you, you're not welcome here. Don't come to the Kaaba, don't come to Mecca with these types of ideas. These are not my ideas. These ideas are from the Holy Book and from the Holy Prophet. They tell you, you can't come here. Quraysh, that was an enemy of Allah's Prophet, stands out more merciful than those who rule Arabia today. So we're not in a struggle with our social self. That regime in Arabia belongs to our social self. But where's the struggle against it? The Prophet went against his own family, extended family. He went against his own relatives. He went against his neighbors, the occupants, the inhabitants of Mecca and of Hijaz. He didn't do this because that was a choice. He had many other choices. He did this because it came natural with being the Prophet that he's supposed to be. We speak about ourselves. Any of us have a character that we can say, oh, I know this brother Muslim. He is a lifetime of struggle, like the Prophet was a lifetime of struggle. He stands against tyranny and injustice, even if that comes from his own backyard, or from his own neighborhood, or from his own city, or from his own people. Who are these individuals? Who are these people? So when the Prophet, alayhi salatu wasalam, was in this struggle with his own people, and it culminated after all of these years of persecution, torture, and dislocation, and economic pressure, and psychological warfare, all of which are available in this world too. After that, Allah Jalla wa Ala gave him a direction towards Al-Quds, as if to say to those who are conforming subjects of Allah, if you are under similar circumstances, the way of light, the way of freedom, the way of liberation is towards Al-Quds. Now today we have many Muslims who speak about a way towards Al-Quds, which is, generally speaking, right. But the unobserved, critical, and central detail in this is, have we provided the prerequisites to that direction towards Al-Quds by being involved in the same type of struggle that our Prophet was involved in? And here we fall short. Can anyone show anything of that? Can you show me? Do you have a history? Do you have 10 or 12 years of a struggle against your social self? Or against, for those who have a problem with that, against your cultural self? Can you show us anything for that? If the Salat al-Ma'raj would have happened at the beginning of the Da'wah, why did it happen after 10 or 11 or 12 years of the Da'wah? There was a timing for it. They asked Allah's Prophet precisely that, an yalqa fis-sama. And the answer to that at the beginning, when they challenged him, hey, wait a minute, you say you're a prophet? Well, produce some evidence. Prophets always bring miracles. Where's your miracle? And the answer to that was, قُلْ سُبْحَانَ رَبِّي هَلْ كُنْتُ إِلَّا بَشَرًا رَسُولًا. Say, exalted is my sustainer, but I'm only a human, a messenger. And this is a miracle. Brothers and sisters, we Muslims, we don't dwell on miracles. We're not like you go to Christian and Jewish history and theology, it's punctuated full of miracles. This is a miracle. In any way you think about it, the Prophet goes all of these distances to the end of existence, as it were, and he comes back in one night. Obviously, this is a miracle. And what is noteworthy here is that it is mentioned that he went on what is called al-buraq. Al-buraq is a derivative word of a word that you're more familiar with. If you're reading the Qur'an, there's a word in the Qur'an, al-barq. فِي ظُلُمَاتٌ وَرَعْدٌ وَبَرْقٌ يَجْعَلُونَ أَصَابِعَهُمْ فِي آذَانِهِمْ مِنَ الصَّوَاعِقِ حَذَرَ الْمَوْتِ. Barq means lightning. And the barq is a derivative of lightning, which, if we wanted to break it down into the chemistry of today's world, we'd probably say it's somewhere between electricity and light. That's al-buraq. So this transfer, it's like if some of you watch TV in the past years, there's an expression there on one of the programs that says, beam me up. So that beam, I mean, it makes you think. These people say they don't read the Quran, they know nothing of this history and everything, and yet they used a term that can be directly related to the Quran, to this history of ours. And here we are struggling with, was that animal closer to a mule or a donkey? A rock. But this is where we are in real life. This is who we are, whether it's looking back at our history and understanding it, whether it's looking at the developments of our time and understanding them, or whether it's trying to relate and intertwine the experiences of the Prophet and his precedents with our obligations and responsibilities today. The other comment that I will wind down on is the destruction, almost physically, of Al-Masjid Al-Haram and Al-Masjid Al-Aqsa. We have two regimes, one of them occupying Arabia, the other one occupying Palestine or the Holy Land. We have many regimes, but this is because we're talking about Al-Masjid Al-Haram and Al-Masjid Al-Aqsa. We have no choice here but to zero in on these two areas. The Masjid al-Haram in Mecca is being, in its own way, physically annihilated. These towers that are going up, they're building commercial enterprises around the Kaaba, hotels, and Starbucks, and everything that's on the blacklist is coming to Mecca. And the Kaaba and the Bayt al-Haram are being miniaturized. Physically. Forget about how they destroyed the Message of Islam. Can we go there and speak about justice around the Kaaba? Can we speak about the equality and we speak about the values and the principles that Allah's prophets, you know, they want us to go there just like automatons. You go through a battery of religious verbiages and then they corral you out as if we're sheeple. That's what they want, that's how they want us to behave around. But in addition to that, now they have, they ask no one, they're asking you and me, this is what we want to do to the Kaaba. What do you think about this? They have an international body of Islamic scholars from around the world. Look, this is what we're thinking about doing. Now, a slap in our face. This is what they're going to do, and this is what they are doing. Whether we like it or whether we don't like it, it doesn't register. And parallel to that is the destruction of a Masjid al-Aqsa by the Zionist regime in Palestine. They are just like, these Zionists are just like termites in the foundations of Al-Masjid Al-Aqsa. They are chipping away at these foundations, and our some sincere brothers in Palestine, they send out SOSs. Look, pay attention. If this thing continues like it is, this Masjid Al-Aqsa is going to collapse. It has no foundational integrity any longer. It has no physical constituency. It's going to fall. But who do you speak to? Muslim masses and crowds around the world, they go to sleep on Fridays during the khutbah. Muslims who have been brainwashed by a Saudi establishment that gets its orders from the United States government, that gets its orders from the Israeli government, that gets its orders from the shaitan himself. When the day comes and we can see that we have to begin a struggle to clean our own house, like Allah's Prophet began cleaning his own house in Mecca. And then the sequence of events began. When that day comes, we will take the first step in understanding the meanings of the Isra and the Mi'raj. سبحان الذي أسرى بعبده ليلا من المسجد الحرام إلى المسجد الأقصى الذي باركنا حوله لنريه من آياتنا إنه هو السميع البصير. أقول قولي هذا وأستغفر الله لي ولكم وصلى الله على محمد وآل محمد وترى ذلك على يسبحون بحمد ربهم وقضي بينهم بالحق وقيل الحمد لله رب العالمين. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.